Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Reading from The 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution. Campaign 1. Let it begin here. The Battle of Lexington and Concord. On April 19, 1775, few on either side of the Atlantic realized that Great Britain and its American colonies stood on the brink of a war that would lead to the establishment of a free and independent American Republic. American colonists had been petitioning King George III in the Parliament for redress of grievances without satisfaction. As the king's American subjects resisted each new law they perceived as arbitrary and a threat to the liberties guaranteed by the Constitution of Great Britain, the government in London reacted by imposing even harsher measures. Resistance to unjust laws became open rebellion when 6 companies of a British Life Infantry marched into Lexington, Massachusetts, and formed a line of battle on the village green facing members of the local militia company. According to tradition, Captain John Parker told the men of his company, "Stand your ground. Don't fire unless fired upon. But if they mean to have a war, let it begin here." Within minutes, shots were fired and Americans were killed. The several colonies, in sympathy with Massachusetts Bay, convened the First Continental Congress to coordinate their mutual support and collective resistance to the coercive acts, and they formed the Continental Association to implement its resolutions. When Lieutenant General Thomas Gage, Commander-in-Chief of His Majesty's Forces in North America, as well as Royal Governor of Massachusetts, dissolved the Massachusetts House of Representatives, the members met in Concord to establish the Extra-Legal Provincial Congress, a shadow government that effectively exercised actual authority outside of Boston. It ordered the towns to stop collecting taxes for the royal government and to forward those funds to the Provisional Congress instead. The shadow government developed a new plan for the militia and ordered the gathering of munitions and military supplies for an army of observation as it began preparing for a potential armed conflict with the ministerial forces. Among its significant acts was the establishment of a select militia. All free males in the colony between the ages of 16 and 60 were required to perform military training as members of the militia and mustered for training at least once annually or more often under certain circumstances. The colony encouraged all the militia units to obtain the skill of complete soldiers by training more often. With political tensions in the colony rising, the Congress formed a select militia directly under the authority of the Executive Committee of Safety, leaving the regular militia under the counties. Consisting of 1/4 of the total force, this select militia recruited younger, physically fit, preferably single, and enthusiastic Whigs. They were armed and accoutred and paid to attend frequent and rigorous training assemblies at public expense. Organized into companies, battalions, and regiments, they were required to assemble and deploy anywhere in the colony at a minute's notice, and hence were called Minutemen. After the British government declared the Massachusetts Bay Colony in a state of rebellion, General Gage had to act. He developed a plan to send a column of his best troops on a swift march to Concord to seize the gunpowder, military stores, and 14 cannon that his informants reported to be stored there for use against the Crown's forces. Having already ordered his regiments occupying Boston to increase their training activities, he hoped the Americans would assume the expedition to be another in a series of such exercises, as it was not unusual for officers to ride horses into the surrounding country for pleasure and physical exercise. Gage instructed them to use the excursions for gathering intelligence. The seizure of the military stores gathered at Concord had become a military necessity as well as a legal requirement. The general wanted the people of other colonies to view his move as a preemptive strike at troublemaking radicals who had broken the law, not an act of aggression against the king's American subjects. He ardently hoped that the judicious use of military force sent to strike the head of the rebellion in Concord might suppress patriots with a single, hopefully bloodless, stroke. On April 15th, of the 13 infantry regiments in Boston, Gage ordered the commanders of the 4th, 5th, 10th, 18th, 23rd, 38th, 43rd, 47th, 52nd, 59th regiments of foot to detach their grenadier and light infantry companies, and Major John Pitcairn, the commander of the attached 1st Battalion British Marines, to provide one company of Marines as well. The 21 companies, about 700 men total, were relieved from routine camp duties purportedly to participate in special training exercises from the new drill manual. General Gage selected the senior regimental commander, Lieutenant Colonel Francis Smith, of the 10th Regiment of Foot, to command the expedition, with Pitcairn, the most senior officer of that rank in Boston, as his second in command. The general presented Smith with various written orders to seize and destroy all artillery, ammunition, provisions, tents, small arms, and all military stores, whatever, found collected at Concord for the avowed purpose of raising and supporting a rebellion against His Majesty. To accomplish his mission, Smith's expedition was to march with the utmost expedition and secrecy from Boston to Concord, a distance of about 20 miles. The soldiers were to be under the strictest discipline and expressly forbidden to plunder the inhabitants or hurt private property. Gage provided Smith with a map that showed the houses, barns, etc., where the military supplies were placed. The soldiers were to spike and knock a trunnion off each gun they found and destroy the carriages. All barrels of gunpowder and flour were to be emptied into the river, all tents burned, pork and beef destroyed. The soldiers were to put as many musket balls into their pockets as they could, throwing all they could not carry into ponds, ditches, etc., but scattered so as not to be easily recovered. As the preparations progressed, General Gage sent a small party on horseback consisting of 10 officers and 10 sergeants, with orders to prevent any Patriot Express riders leaving Boston from alerting the militia along the way or Patriot leaders in Concord before Smith's men got there. The general requested his Royal Navy counterpart, Vice Admiral Samuel Graves, commanding the North American station, to provide sailors and ships' boats from the warships moored in the harbor to move the troops from the city to Letchmore Point on the north bank of Back Bay of the Charles River. From there, they could march into the interior without parading through Boston and alerting the Patriot informants. Despite the attempted secrecy, the Patriot Sons of Liberty in Boston soon guessed what was afoot and sent a message of warning to Concord, where the Provincial Congress was then meeting. The Congress immediately adjourned on April 15th. On the evening of April 18th, the light infantry, grenadiers, and marines of the British were ordered out of their barracks, which were at several locations in Boston, and marched to an assembly area at the common near the bank of the Charles River. At about 9:30 that evening, they began boarding the boats. When it was discovered that the Navy had not allocated enough boats, only about half of the troops and supplies embarked. The rest waited idle for about 2 hours while the boats made the round trip to Letchmore Point. The second half of the troops did not disembark on the far shore until midnight. The British wasted more time in arranging the order of march, getting the light infantry companies to the head of the column, trudging through the marshy ground, and waiting for the provisions to be brought ashore. When Smith finally gave the order to march, high tide flooded the marsh. The troops had to wade through the water that in some places had risen to a depth of 3 feet for about a quarter of a mile before they reached the bridge over Willis Creek and a good dry road. Preceded by an advance party of several mounted officers and a loyalist civilian guide, who acted as scouts and detained colonists found on the road who might spread the alarm and alert the militia. The column was finally marching towards Lexington by 1:30 that morning. At dusk, while the British troops were still at the common, a member of Lexington's militia company observed one of Gage's mounted patrols and informed Orderly Sergeant William Monroe, who was also the proprietor of Monroe's Tavern. Believing the patrol had come to arrest Patriot leaders John Hancock and Samuel Adams, who were staying at the nearby home of Reverend Jonah Clark, Monroe mounted a 9-man guard at the parsonage. The sergeant also sent a messenger to alert Captain Parker and ordered 3 men to follow the patrol when it continued towards Concord. The captain immediately ordered the company to muster. The meeting house bell rang the alarm, and within about 30 minutes, or at about 1 that morning, 130 men of Lexington's militia company stood in ranks on the green, a 2-acre triangle of public land in the center of town. After a short deliberation with the other officers, Parker determined that they could not provoke the regulars if they approached, even should they insult us. After they filed a volley to clear their weapons, Parker dismissed the men. Some of the men returned to their homes, but others went into Buckman's Tavern just across the road. British General Gage's plan had become an open secret. Only the details of the operation were unknown. Dr. Joseph Warren, leader of the Sons of Liberty, activated the Patriots' warning system and alerted express riders Paul Revere and William Dawes to spread the alarm with the assistance of fellow Liberty Boys in Boston, Cambridge, and Charlestown. 2 compatriots rowed Paul Revere across to Charlestown, carefully avoiding the British ship of the line Somerset, moored near the ferry way. Provided with a strong horse, Revere waited for the signal on the steeple of Christ Church, also called Old North Church, that was to tell him that the British were being ferried across Back Bay, not marching out via the Boston Neck. Although aware that the British were watching to intercept alarm riders, Warren also sent Dawes to Lexington by the alternate route, by land across Boston Neck. Other riders stood ready to fan out should Revere and Dawes be stopped by the British, to make sure Adams and Hancock were warned. Dawes passed the guard post on the Boston Neck without incident, and both riders arrived at Reverend Clark's before Smith's troop had left Lurchmere Point. After speaking with Adams and Hancock, Revere and Dawes remounted their horses and were soon riding towards Concord. When they had only 2 more miles to go, one of the British mounted patrols surprised and captured Revere and Dawes, as well as Dr. Samuel Prescott, an ardent patriot who had met them as he returned home from visiting his fiancée in Concord. Their captors forced them into a nearby pasture for questioning. Prescott agreed to help Revere and Dawes spread the alarm. On a signal, Prescott and Revere spurred their horses, riding in opposite directions, while Dawes turned and galloped back towards Lexington. Prescott and Dawes managed to outrun their pursuers, but Revere was recaptured. When threatened with summary execution unless he divulged the Patriots' plans, Revere told them that he had alarmed the country and 500 militiamen now stood between them and Boston. He added that the boats transporting Smith's men had run aground and they should not expect any help. The patrol retreated, but when they heard the musketry, unaware it was Parker's men clearing unspent cartridges from their muskets, the officers thought it inadvisable to pass around Lexington. After commandeering Revere's horse to replace the tired mount of a sergeant, they released Revere and the 3 militiamen Monroe sent to shadow them, whom they had captured. Revere immediately returned to Clark's parsonage to inform Hancock and Adams of what had transpired. In the meantime, the column of British troops continued towards Lexington as church bells and musket shots sounded the alarm in their various towns. They had lost the element of surprise. The advance party encountered more traffic on the road than they expected to find in the pre-dawn hours. Farmers heading to market in Boston were detained, and 3 militiamen Captain Parker had sent to scout the road to Boston were captured and sent back to Pecterin and Smith for questioning. It was now 3 a.m, and the column had not yet reached Lexington, nor had the militia been alerted to its approach. Smith sent Pecterin marching ahead with the 6 leading companies of light infantry to get into Lexington quickly. As the detachment drew closer to town, and the officers observed armed men watching from the high ground, Pecterin ordered out flankers as a precaution against ambush by the militia. He gave the command for the troops to load their muskets, but cautioned them not to fire unless ordered to do so. The Lexington Company of Militia had reassembled after scouts reported the British were only a few miles away and approaching fast. Parker ordered the company drummer, 16-year-old William Diamond, to beat to arms, and the company began to assemble near the northwest corner of the 2-acre triangular common facing the fork in the road from Boston. About 70 men were standing in the ranks when the first British company appeared with the sound of drums and fifes at about 5 that morning. Other militiamen were still on their way, and several spectators stood along the boundaries of the green or watched from their homes. The light infantry formed into line of battle facing the militia as Major Pecterin approached, accompanied by the officers of the advance party of the British. Waving his sword as his horse cantered toward them, Major Pecterin ordered the militiamen, "Lay down your arms." Other officers shouted, "Disperse, ye rebels, and surrender." Parker faced about and immediately ordered the militia to disperse and not to fire. As they broke ranks and slowly started heading home carrying their weapons, Major Pecterin ordered his men not to fire but to surround and disarm them. As the light infantrymen advanced, a shot was fired by an unknown gunman. Regardless of who fired, the shot confirmed the suspicions men on either side had about their opponents. With a shout, the British regulars rushed furiously, fired upon and killed 8 of our party without our receiving any provocation there from us, according to Parker. The British soldiers then went about their work with the bayonet, while their officers desperately attempted to bring them under discipline. The company officers were just restoring order when Lieutenant Colonel Smith rode into the chaotic scene. He ordered a drummer to beat to arms, at which the officers ceased firing and formed back into their ranks. The Lieutenant Colonel rebuked them for their lack of discipline and ignoring their officers' commands. At about 10 minutes, the rest of the British column arrived. After giving 3 cheers and firing a volley to signal their victory, the march to Concord resumed at about 5:30 that morning. 1 British soldier had been wounded in the leg, and Major Pecterin's horse had been hit by 2 musket balls. 4 Lexington militia soldiers lay dead or mortally wounded on the green, with another 4 dead nearby. 10 more wounded militiamen limped or staggered to safety. With the British marching towards their town, the people of Concord, although unaware of the deadly encounter at Lexington, worked feverishly to hide the ammunition, ordnance, and other military stores that had been gathered in the neighborhood. Around dawn, Colonel James Barrett, who had commanded the local militia regiment, alerted the 2 companies, each of militia and minutemen, to muster at the Wright Tavern in the center of town. The Minuteman Company from Lincoln soon arrived, bringing the news of a confrontation in Lexington. Shortly thereafter, a scout returned to report that the regulars had fired on Parker's company and were headed in their direction. Barrett ordered Captain David Brown and his Minuteman Company to advance along the road junction at Merriam's Corner, and for Captains Nathan Barrett and George Minot to advance theirs along the ridge parallel to the road to guard his flank. The colonel ordered the remaining companies to the crest of the high ground above the town's burial ground, which was on the same ridge, vainly hoping the British were under orders not to engage if opposed by militia. When the British advance guard saw the Minutemen in the road ahead at Merriam's Corner and the companies on the burial ridge, Smith had the light infantry deploy to the flank on the high ground. As ordered, the outnumbered Minutemen on the ridge retreated. when the Grenadiers and Marines resumed marching, Captain Brown's Minutemen forced about smartly and marched off in good military order in front of them, remaining so close that they fell in step with the cadence of the British drums. When the three companies had returned, Colonel Barrett ordered his men to withdraw to high ground 400 yards to the north of town. The first British troops entered Concord at about 7 that morning. As the light infantry descended from the ridge to join their comrades in town, they cut down Concord's Liberty Pole. Lieutenant Colonel Smith was pleased that his expedition had reached Concord without further incident and ordered the British soldiers to find and destroy all the military supplies and equipment hidden in Concord. He sent one light infantry company to secure the South Bridge over the Sudbury River and ordered Captain Lawrence Parsons of the 10th Regiment to lead 7 light infantry companies to the North Bridge. From there, he would detach 3 companies to secure his line of retreat in the event of trouble, and with the other 4, advance 2 miles to the Barrett Farm, where spies reported some cannon and military supplies were stored. Since the British outnumbered his 250 men, at about 8 that morning, Captain Nathan Barrett ordered his men to retreat across the bridge to Punkatasset Hill, the high ground a mile west of town on the west side of the Concord River, to wait for reinforcements. The colonel placed Major John Buttrick of the Minutemen Battalion in temporary command, and then raced to make certain the weapons and supplies at his farm were well concealed before Parsons arrived. Major Buttrick divided the troops into 2 battalions, with the Minuteman companies on the right and the militia companies on the left. As more arrived, they would fall in with their respective battalions. He also appointed Lieutenant Joseph Hosmer to serve as the acting adjutant to assist in forming the ad hoc brigade. Buttrick then commanded the troops to advance to a lower hill closer to the west bank of the river that served as a local muster field. Meanwhile, Smith and Pitcairn of the British stayed in the center of town to maintain control as the Grenadiers and Marines went about the task they had been sent to accomplish, ensuring that they took no untoward liberties with private property or local citizens. The British soldiers succeeded in finding and disabling some cannons. Artillery carriages, tents, cartridge paper, and entrenching tools were collected into piles and set on fire. Barrels of musket balls and flour were thrown into the mill pond, but much of it later recovered by the Patriots. Other sacks of flour and the chest that contained the treasury of the Provincial Congress went unmolested when the colonists convinced the soldiers they were private property. When sparks from the burning military items ignited a fire on the roofs of the townhouse and other nearby buildings, Mrs. Martha Moulton demanded that British officers order their men to extinguish the flames before they caused any destruction. Back at the North Bridge, Captain Walter S. Lurie of the 43rd Regiment, the officer in charge of the British Light Infantry Companies detached to secure the span, watched nervously as more companies joined the American force on the hill above them, only about 400 yards away. The captains of the other 2 companies saw them as well and thought it prudent to leave their forward positions and rejoin Lowry's men at the bridge. After conferring with his fellow officers there, Lowry sent a subordinate to inform Lieutenant Colonel Smith of the developing situation and request reinforcements. That officer returned with the news that reinforcements were on their way. Captain Lurie then had the 3 companies take a defensive stance on the east bank of the river, where they could still guard the bridge and allow Parsons' men to cross. Colonel Barrett returned at about 9 that morning to learn that his force had been reinforced to 6 Minuteman and 5 militia companies, or about 500 men. Having now learned of the bloodshed at Lexington, the militiamen were looking to avenge their neighbors. Barrett conferred with Major Buttrick and Lieutenant Colonel John Robinson, second in command of a Minuteman regiment that was still marching to Concord to decide their next move. Tradition holds that when he saw the smoke rising from the burning wood, canvas, and paper items, Lieutenant Hosmer asked, "Will you let them burn down the town?" Colonel Barrett gave the order for the men to load their muskets and prepare to march into Concord. Officers took the post with their units and informed them of the mission, and Colonel Barrett's order not to fire their weapons unless the regulars at the British fired first. Major Buttrick ordered his battalion of Minutemen to face to the right in a column of two files. When he commanded the companies forward, they stepped off with the Acton Company of Captain Isaac Davis first. As a mounted Colonel Barrett watched them pass, he kept repeating his order not to fire first. With the drums beating the cadence and fifers playing Wak Cockade, Barrett's Patriot troops marched down the hill to the riverbank, then left onto a causeway that carried the road through the marsh, which was inundated when the river overflowed its banks with the recent spring freshets. Robinson, Buttrick, and Davis marched near the head of the column as it approached the bridge. The British officers were impressed by the regularity with which the colonial militia advanced. Laurier ordered all his men to the east bank and directed one company into the adjacent fields to the left and right of the road and the other two companies to form for street fighting and to prepare to fire by divisions. In this manner, the men in the front rank would fire a volley, then retire to the rear of the formation to reload as the second rank stepped forward to fire, and the process repeated through the entire formation. While the tactic maintained continuous firing, the fire was directed on a narrow front. As they waited for the Americans to draw closer, Laurie ordered some men to remove the planks from the bridge, which might slow the Americans, but would also strand Parsons' detachment on the far side. They did not accomplish their task. Reading from The 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.